All right, let's see, what are we dealing with here? Transposition of the great vessels. I can tell you what the main question is on boards related to this. Okay, and it isn't really related to a transposition, actually. Are you familiar with the immotile cilia syndrome? Cartagener syndrome? You know, when, like, say, the heart's on the right side versus the left, the liver's on the right, on the left side versus the right? They try to make you say that in a complete transposition of the great vessels, that that's what's happening when you have Cartagener syndrome, that everything is switched. No, it isn't. It's just that you have a normal heart with everything the normal, it's on your right side. That's the one they usually ask in relation. They try to get you to say that's a transposition, but it isn't. It's just a normal heart on the right side of your chest as opposed to the left. That's what they usually ask. But let's just discuss it a little bit because it's not that high yield the factor. What's transposed? Well, it's not the atria. The right atrium is still getting unoxygenated blood. Okay? It's not the left atrium. That's not transposed. That's still getting 95% oxygen-saturated blood from the pulmonary vein. No problem there. The problem is in the ventricles. What's happening is the right ventricle is being emptied by the aorta. That's not cool. That is not a cool thing. Okay? Not cool. Okay? And to add insult to injury, the left ventricle is emptied by the pulmonary artery. So the thing that's transposed is in the ventricles. The right ventricle is being emptied by the aorta. The left ventricle is being emptied by the pulmonary artery. The atria are fine. Okay? Now, obviously, this is incompatible with life unless you have shunts. Okay? And so you always have usually three shunts to work. You have an atrial, you have a patent foramen ovale, you got a septal defect, and you got a patent ductus. So let's see how this would work. Okay? Let's start up at the atrial side here. Okay, remember you have 95% O2 saturation here in the left atrium, and that's going left to right. So what happens in the right atrium? Step up of oxygen in the right atrium, all right? Let's bring it on down here. So it's a step up here, so we have a step up of oxygen in the right ventricle, right? Right? And that's going to go out. Some of it's going to go out the aorta. Okay, aorta. Is that good? Yes. And then some of it's going to go into this direction, into the left ventricle. Is that correct? All right. Is that good? Well, yeah, because it's going to go into the right ventricle. What's the left ventricle being emptied by? Pulmonary artery. And that's going back to the lungs to get oxygenated. So you actually have to have all of these things working. Otherwise, a right ventricle being emptied by the aorta would just be all unoxygenated blood, and a left ventricle being emptied by the pulmonary artery would not be cool. And so by having these shunts, you can get around the difficulties with this thing. You need an atrial septal defect so you can get oxygenated blood into the right atrium, and then from the right atrium, there'd be a step up of oxygen in the right ventricle, and that's being emptied by the aorta. Now, obviously, it's not 95% saturated, maybe 80%, and that's why you have cyanosis in these patients. But at least you can get some blood out the aorta that has some oxygen in it to the patient, and they can at least survive for a little while. Okay, and then you have the right to left shunt going on over here, and then that blood is being emptied in the left ventricle by the pulmonary artery, which is good because that's going to the lungs and getting oxygenated. So you have to have these shunts in order for the patient to live. If you don't even understand what I just said, it's okay, because they haven't been asked it a whole lot. But just know that the one they usually ask, they're trying to convince you that you have a complete transposition of the vessels when you have Cartagener syndrome. No, you don't. You have a normal heart on the right side. That's the one they usually ask. Coarctation, I think, is a fun one. You have preductal and postductal. What's pre mean? Before ductus. What's post mean? After ductus. So preductal would be over here. Let's say the ductus is, let's say, over here. It'd be before it, whereas postductal, it would be after the patent ductus there, or the ligamentum arteriosum. Now, preductals occur in Turner syndrome. That's one of their more common congenital heart diseases, is Turner's will have preductal coarctations, and they go right into failure. And so they have to be corrected. Postductals aren't present at birth. Postductals actually can occur any time in a patient's adult life. Okay, so you may be working on one right now, who knows? Okay, so they're not present at birth. They come on in as an adult. And they're important to recognize because They're a surgically correctable cause of hypertension, as we'll see. Now, the reason I like coarctation is that anyone that has half a brain in the head doesn't have to memorize anything. All you can do is figure it out. So I'm going to talk aloud, like I'm doing now, and just kind of logically talk about this thing. So we have the stenosis over here in the aorta. So let's just, I'm going to think about what's happening proximal. Well, I could see that there's going to be a problem getting blood through that. So I can hear a murmur there, which would probably be heard right between the shoulder blades. Okay, so it would be a systolic murmur between the shoulder blades. I can see there'd be a lot of pressure build up proximally, so I can see that this would dilate this proximal aorta and be a lot of pressure going up those branch vessels, like your subclavians, your internal carotid. So the blood pressure in the upper extremity is going to be higher, certainly, than it is in the lower. And then also, because there's increased blood flow going into the brain, right at the junction of where the communicating branches hit the main branch of the cerebral vessels, and all of us in this room, and everyone in this room, we all have this, guys. We're all born with this, okay? Right at the junction between the communicating branches and the main cerebral vessel, we have no internal elastic lamina and no smooth muscle there. So it's a weak area in everyone in this room. Okay, so that means then that all of us have the potential for developing barioneurysms. Okay, but what would exacerbate or make that a realistic thing? Hypertension. So, you know, it drives me crazy when I hear about, you know, adult polycystic kidney disease. You know, you have 20 to 25% of cases has barioneurysms. You know, so what? I mean, so what? Of course you do. You know, you also have an increased incidence in essential hypertension and coarctations. Any cause of hypertension can produce a barioneurysm because the bottom line is hypertension. We all have the same defect. Okay? And so if you have hypertension, you run a risk of developing a barioneurysm right at that junction. All of us do. From any cause of hypertension. It's not unique to adult polycystic kidney disease. It's because they have hypertension in adult polycystic kidney disease that they develop that. And they make this big deal out of it as if this is a very unusual relationship. Baloney! Baloney, it's not. I mean, oh, they go jumping up and down. Oh, baloney, it's not. But anyway. So I can see lots of pressures going up there. I can see subarachnoid bleeds and all kinds of crap. I can also see that we're probably going to stretch the aortic valve ring and get a murmur of aortic regurgitation. Can you see that too? That's by that dilatates, kind of like a syphilitic aortic aneurysm. You're kind of stretching a little bit, huh? I also can see that, what else can I see? Oh! All that pressure on the wall of that proximal aorta could potentially predispose it for a dissecting aortic aneurysm because you get a little damage in there in the elastic artery, you run a risk for dissections, and that's true too. Now, what do I see distal to this thing? I see decreased blood flow. I see claudication. Now, claudication basically is angina of the peripheral vessels, and that basically means when they walk, they get calf pain or buttock pain. And then they stop, okay, and it goes away. When they walk, it hurts, and that kind of sound like angina of the chest, okay, but it really is. It's ischemia. And, of course, the muscle development in the lower extremity is not going to be too good. Agreed? So you're going to have claudication. I can see the muscle mass is going to be decreased. The blood pressure is going to be different between the lower extremity and the upper extremity. I also see that the blood flow to the renal arteries decreased. Do you? And that means you're going to activate the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, and you're going to have hypertension. Agreed? So the hypertension in patients with coarctation is activation of the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. Ooh. So it's a high renin hypertension. Wow. So that means if I can correct this dude, then that hypertension should go away. Mm-hmm. Now, we've got a problem, just like we have problems when we have roadblocks, don't we? We've got to try to get around them, huh? Okay, so we've got to get collaterals. This is not a good place to have a block in aorta because you only got two ways to get around this. The one that's the rarest one is the superficial epigastric artery with the internal mammary artery. You can get around this. Now, the superficial epigastric artery actually is pretty famous. Okay, does anybody remember what the importance of that is, that little triangle down there when you're doing hernia examinations? Isn't that the lateral border of the triangle of, what is that, Hesselbeck? Mm-hmm. It's the superficial epigastric artery. So that when you stick your finger in the canal, okay, and you've got a hernia that's coming down and hitting you, an indirect inguinal hernia, right to the medial side of your finger, you're going to feel pulsation, and that's the superficial epigastric artery. So that can collateralize with the internal mammary and get around this. I've never heard of that on the exam yet. But the other one you all know is the intercostals. Okay, and since they're on the undersurface of the ribs and they're getting all this excess blood through them, they produce notching, which you can see, of course, on an x-ray, and so you get rib notching. And that's coarctation. You don't even have to really memorize anything. It all makes sense. Agreed? All right. That's coarctation of the aorta. These are the major risk factors for coronary heart disease. This comes from the JAMA article, which was a consensus article on coronary heart artery disease. Let me just give you some clues on board exams. Okay, where do boards get things that they want to test? Okay, I can tell you one is JAMA consensus articles. Every time they do some consensus article on how to treat hyperlipidemia or risk factors for coronary heart disease, or that one where the increased morbidity and mortality in the United States, you know, smoking, lack of exercise, alcohol, those kinds of big articles they take questions from. Another one of the medical progress articles when they deal with a general subject that are in the New England Journal. That's another one they like to pick things out of. Okay, for that one. That's where they got that, you know, triad thing for ruptured aortic aneurysm and many, many other things. So, you know, I don't usually read the New England Journal because it's too esoteric. It's an absolute waste of my time. But when I see medical progress discussing dissections or this or that, read it. Because that's the state of the art, because those are all peer-reviewed things, and they basically set the stage for this is how you're going to do it from now on. And so when this article came out, and I forget the year, 1990-something, these replaced all the major risk factors that were previous to it. Now, pretty much the same, except there's a few differences. Turns out that age is your most important risk factor, and you can't control that. I mean, you can try with plastic surgery and all that kind of stuff, but you still are whatever you are. Now, the magic number for us guys is not good, 45. That's one against me. I'm 58. Not good. For you women, you lucky little suckers. God must just love you more than us. Okay, 55 for you. And why do you think that is? Your estrogen, you dirty rats. Your estrogen. Well, what does estrogen have to do with the time of day? It's your HDL. Why do you think your HDLs are 100-something? Did you know that your risk factor for coronary artery disease is not LDL? It's your HDL. Lots of you have LDLs that are bad. Okay, why? You eat lousy and this and that. Doesn't mean a hill of beans. Your HDL is 80, 100, doesn't matter. Why? Because, remember, HDL, reverse cholesterol transport. What do you think that's talking about? Cholesterol going in reverse? No. It's HDL visiting your fatty streaks in your vessels, sucking the LDL out of it, internalizing it, bringing it back to the liver, and giving it to the liver to metabolize, you lucky suckers. So your HDL is your risk factor, not LDL. So 55 is when you reach menopause. And so if you're not taking estrogen and the estrogens go down, your HDL levels go down into male's range, and then your risk goes up big time. That's why it's 55 for you, 45 for us. That's the most important risk factor. Family history of premature coronary heart disease or stroke, I might add. Current cigarette smoking, in the old days, used to be greater than 10 cigarettes. Now it's any smoking. Hypertension was always there. HDL less than 35 was always there. Diabetes was always there. Notice, cholesterol is not a major risk factor. LDL is. Now, why do you think that is? Because all therapeutic decisions, all diagnoses of hypercholesterolemia is based on LDL, not cholesterol. Small point, but it is a point. And notice there's a negative risk factor. If your HDL is greater than 60, you can subtract one from your major risk factor. So, for example, I'm a 58, that one against me. My HDL was greater than 60, and unfortunately it ain't. Okay? It's 40-something. And I'm not taking estrogen to get it higher. I refuse to do that. I refuse. I don't want to get a higher voice and boobs. I do not want that. I don't need boobs. All right. So I'll just deal with my 45, 48, whatever that sucker is, and that's it. That's just too bad. Okay. So I got one risk factor against them. But if it was greater than 60, I could subtract that, and I have no risk factors. So that's new. So make sure you have at least some familiarity with this. What I do with my students is I do a stem, and I put all these different facts in it, and they have to tell me how many major risk factors does the patient have. I could see the board's doing the same thing. Why? Because that's what you should be doing when you do a history on a person with anything, right? See what their risk factors are. So why wouldn't the boards do that? Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about angina. Let's talk about ischemic heart disease. It's got four types, right? We've got angina. We've got a myocardial infarction. We have sudden cardiac death syndrome. What's the not breathing, heart stop. That's what the is. Okay, and then we have chronic ischemic heart disease. Those are the four ischemic heart diseases. Let's dispense with ones that just require just a couple comments. Sudden cardiac death syndrome is death within 1 hour. I don't know how you determine that when the patient's dead, but whatever. Tell me, when did you die? Did you die within an hour? And you get no response. Okay. Nothing sacred with me, is it? No, not really. What are you afraid of death for? I'm not. Are you? Well, I don't care. But anyway, sudden cardiac death syndrome, you die within an hour. Now, what are you going to see at autopsy? Well, I can tell you what you're not going to see. You're not going to see a coronary thrombus. That'd be uncommon. You will not see a thrombus, but you will see severe coronary artery atherosclerosis. So the key to remember is usually you don't have a thrombus. And so, but you do have severe coronary artery disease. So how do you die? Well, you get ischemia. You start getting a couple of premature ventricular contractions, and then when it hits that susceptible area there, you get an R on T phenomenon, V-fib, no one's around to resuscitate you, you're dead. So you die of a ventricular arrhythmia, just like you do with a myocardial infarction. Of course, if you die so fast, there's no changes in the heart. You're not going to have pallor and coagulation necrosis. So really, all you see is we check everything out to make sure there isn't any other possible explanation for it. We see the severe coronary artery disease, and that's it. So we sign it out, sudden cardiac death syndrome. If you're a smoker, you can count on getting that. It's a great risk for a sudden cardiac death in smokers. Very, very high. Very, very high. Now, chronic ischemic heart disease is a lot of our parents, you know, and our aunts and uncles, okay, who have coronary artery disease, had little infarcts, you know, or they had a small heart attack. They're basically talking about subendocardial infarctions. But what happens is the muscle gets replaced by fibrous tissue. And so eventually that before left ventricle is just basically all fibrous tissue and hardly any muscle. The ejection fraction is 0.20 versus 0.66, and you just die of heart failure. That's called chronic ischemic heart disease. Fibrous tissue has no contractility. That's very common, chronic ischemic heart disease. That's the second most common indication for heart transplant, is chronic ischemic heart disease. So let's deal with angina now, which is the most common ischemic heart disease. We have three types, exertional, Prince Metal, and unstable or resting angina. You know that exertional or classical angina is when you get chest pain, when you're exerting yourself, which goes away within 5 or 10 minutes of resting. You know that when you do a treadmill examination on them, you get ST depression. Here's an example. This is a resting EKG in a patient that got on a treadmill and they got ST depression. Depending on what you're using for your criteria, most people use anywhere from 1 millimeter to 2 millimeter ST depression. Some people just go right in the middle, 1.5, and it's a positive test. And therefore, now you're a candidate for a coronary angiogram to see what's going on. Okay, so that's the classic exertional angina situation. Okay, Prince Metals is usually seen in women, usually occurs in the morning. That's nothing special. Most myocardial infarctions occur in the morning, too. And that's due to vasospasm of the coronary artery, not atherosclerosis, but spasm. And some people are implicating thromboxane A2 as the responsible for that vasoconstriction. So that really has nothing to do with atherosclerosis, more spasm. Now, I'm not much on EKGs. I'm really not very good on it. But I do know this. ST depression means subendocardial ischemia. I want you to remember the coronary arteries penetrate the outside of the heart and go in. So who gets screwed normally? The endocardium, the subendocardial tissue, because it's furthest from the blood supply. Okay? So if, for example, you have coronary artery atherosclerosis and you have decreased blood flow automatically, then who really gets screwed? The subendocardium, and it reacts to it with pain and ST depression. Now, when you have vasospasm of a coronary artery, you get transmural ischemia. So when there's ischemia throughout the full thickness of the myocardium, that produces ST elevation. So that should not surprise you why Prince Metal's angina has ST elevation, because it's a transmural ischemia, not a subendocardial ischemia like an exertional angina. So that's the reason, because of the vasospasm, the whole myocardial tissue is being affected, and you get ST elevation with that. Unstable or resting angina or pre-infarction angina is where you get angina just resting. And so the classic history is they had initially classical angina. Now they say, hey, doc, you know that chest pain I was complaining about? I get it when I'm just sitting now. Well, that means they have unstable angina. And they're always put in a hospital. They get angiogrammed and then usually end up with angioplasty, okay, depending on how many vessels involved or a CABG procedure. You don't put them on a treadmill. Don't put an unstable angina. But do not do that, okay, because they'll die. Okay, they're going to die. Not a good idea. Not unless you have a pathologist there. Okay, you can have a pathologist there, that's okay. All right, that's those little suckers. This is what a CABG looks like. Coronary artery, this is the coronary angiogram with some stenosis there. Remember, what veins do they use? Saphenous veins. Remember, they have to tie off the little tributaries, otherwise we're going to have a leaky one. Okay, and remember that over 10 years, that vein's suddenly going to make a little change, isn't it? It's going to get arteriolized. In other words, it looks exactly like an artery. You take a vein and you put arterial pressures into it, it'll actually change its histology and look exactly like an artery. And as you know, that they have a high tendency for fibrosing off after 10 years because of the fact that they're veins. One question just dealt with, what vein do they use? You know, saphenous vein. Okay. Now, the internal mammary, you know, is fantastic because it's an artery. So it's not going to get the same problems because it's used to those pressures. Not only that, it's right there. You just kind of transpose it over. And so they remain patent big time, you know, no problem. But you can't do four vessel bypasses with one internal mammary artery. Okay, so that's the problem with that one. So the thing what you want to remember for part one is that they use a saphenous vein, and that it has a tendency of undergoing fibrosis over time because it becomes arterialized with the pressure. And that they can also use the internal mammary artery. That's what you have to know. Okay. Okay, let's talk about the baddie, acute myocardial infarction. Now, we've seen this one already, this picture. I think I showed you. Where did I show you this picture? I did show you somewhere. Oh, yeah, when we did the thrombosis thing in fluid and hemodynamics, yeah. Now, what did we say that this thrombus was composed of, please, just to make sure we got each other? It's a platelet, group of platelets held together by what? Fibrin. So really, tissue plasminogen activator doesn't have a really big-time problem with this because plasmin, all it has to do is break those fibrin bonds holding them together, the thing just falls apart. Okay, it certainly have a much bigger problem trying to break down a venous clot because then it's got lots more fibrin and crap like that to get through. This is pretty easy. Okay, and then, of course, you run the risk of reperfusion injury because then that oxygenated blood goes into that injured tissue, superoxide free radicals, calcium, a couple of those injured myocardial cells will now die. But that's it. Once those little dudes die, then there's not any further extension. So actually it improves longevity. Let's talk about some of the complications. And I put just about every good picture that I have in my pathology set here, because you're going to get one of these or two of these, okay, because these are all that are out there, right? So I put them all in here, all the complications of myocardial infarctions. All right, what I've done on these things, I've made the anterior part of the heart always on the top, posterior on the bottom. I've made the left side of the heart on your left and the right ventricle on your right to make it easy for you, okay, on all these different things, at least most of them. Let's talk about the vessels and what they supply. The left anterior descending coronary is the most common one, thrombosed, and it supplies the entire anterior part of your heart, entire anterior part, and the anterior two-thirds of the interventricular septum. So you can see right here that this paleness in here, pale infarct, you can see the entire anterior part, and you can see there's the septum right there. The anterior two-thirds is knocked off. And went right in the entire distribution. Now, didn't you learn, I don't know where, maybe during these lectures, during the other people when they talked about anatomy and stuff like that, where are most of your bundles, conduction bundles? The anterior two-thirds of the... And so, if you have complete heart block that requires a pacemaker, what's the most likely vessel that was thrombosed? The left anterior descending, because you wiped the whole sucker out. Does that make sense to you? They asked that. Now, the second most common one is the right coronary artery thrombosis, which is a lot more interesting. And that supplies the entire posterior part of the heart and the posterior one-third of the interventricular septum and the entire right ventricle. Wow! The entire right ventricle. So, posterior section, posterior one-third, entire right ventricle. Now, watch this. Watch this. You know, mitral valve got two valves, right? And you have these papillary muscles. There's the posteromedial papillary muscle, posteromedial papillary muscle. So who do you think supplies if it's posterior? Right coronary artery. Okay? Now we got SA node, sinoatrial, and atrial ventricular node. Now SA node has an equal distribution between left and right, so no problems. But the AV node is 95% supplied by branches from the right coronary artery, which brings up some very interesting complications. For example, if they say, got a patient that has a mitral regurgitation type of murmur, okay, you know, that would be related to posteromedial papillary muscle dysfunction, or actually, breaks, then you know that was a right coronary artery thrombosis because the posteromedial papillary muscle supplies that. Because the right coronary artery supplies that muscle. So a murmur of mitral regurg that occurs during a myocardial infarction would be due to a right coronary artery. If you knock off the AV node, sinus bradycardia. That would be a right coronary artery. And then atypical chest pain. Remember, when you have LADs, usually you have the substernal classical chest pain, radiation down the left arm, maybe into the jaw. But the right coronary artery is dangerous because there you get sometimes epigastric pain. So sometimes you get an atypical chest pain with the right coronary artery thrombosis, and it simulates gastroesophageal reflux disease. I can't tell you how many people have been sent home with Pepto-Bismol when they should have been sent to a hospital and ended up dying at home. And then, of course, they autopsy them, and they find out they have a right coronary artery thrombosis, and the lawyers are all over the duck. Okay, and so you got some older person that's complaining of severe epigastric pain. You better really, 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 really be very, very cautious about how you're going to work that patient up, because it could be GERD, or it could be a right coronary artery thrombosis. So they're the dangerous ones, the right coronary artery thrombosis. Now, I know that you're probably forced to memorize the gross and microscopic features. Myocardial infarctions, you know, 0, 4, 12, 24, 3 days, that's all total bullcrap. Total bullcrap. Because when I was writing my book in pathology, I got all these different articles out, and everyone had a different version of it. Now, what does that mean? It's an unbelievably lousy science for dating. It don't work. It's just like telling a person, well, when is Joe going to die? And you say, 2 hours and 3 minutes. Okay? I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. You can't really say when someone's going to die. And I can tell you this, you can't really say, you know, exactly when the myocardial infarction is based on gross and micro. It's total bullcrap. Total bullcrap. So what do you need to know? You need to know when the heart is softest and has the chance for rupturing. That's important. And that's between 3 days and 7 days. Between the third and seventh days when the heart is softest, and that's when ruptures occur. That's important. Another thing, and this is pretty reasonable, when do you actually first see gross manifestation of that you can look at the heart and say, hey, this looks a little pale. This looks like it might be a pale infarct. 24 hours. That might be useful. I don't know. 24 hours, you can actually first begin seeing maybe some paleness of the myocardium and an infarction. Okay? In terms of coagulation necrosis, maybe that starts in 4 to 6 hours. you might be able to see that. All right, so let's go through some pictures here. We know this is a left anterior descending coronary artery thrombosis because we see a pale infarct involving the entire anterior part of the heart, two-thirds there. This is a rupture, guys, okay? This is the pericardium. It's filled with blood, and right over there, there's a rupture, and blood has gone out. Most of them are anterior, and which means then that most ruptures of the heart occur with left anterior descending thrombosis. Okay, so here's a rupture there, and a hemopericardium. How would that manifest itself? About a patient, maybe day three, day four, they complain of chest pain, and then you listen to them, and they have muffled heart sounds, and neck veins are distended, and you know they've ruptured. Okay, not a whole lot you can do for them. It's a nice, easy way of going out, actually. You know, that's it. All right, here's a rupture, too. This is the posterior medial papillary muscle here, and the chordae tendineae is ruptured from it because it was infarcted in there, so what kind of vessel was the thrombus there? Right coronary artery, good. And what would the murmur be? Mitral regurgitation. So it'd be something like this. On day three, somebody goes into heart failure. Okay, so you're listening to their chest, your pan-systolic murmur, apex increases on expiration, S3, S4 heart sound. It wasn't there the day before. I mean, duh! That means that the posterior medial papillary muscle is either dysfunctional because it's infarcted or ruptured. Okay, so you can hear a murmur with this, and it's going to be something that wasn't there before. It suddenly arises between day 3 and 7. That's an easy one. Of course, they go into heart failure because of the fact that you get massive, volume overload that goes right back into the lungs. A couple more pictures. This is a great one. This has been on so many boards. This one over here. Here's your left ventricle, right ventricle. Here's your pericardial sac, and there's your rupture right there. And the blood went right into this. It's an anterior wall. Okay, this is another one for papillary muscle rupture that has been on boards, and this is it right here. The only muscle, or the papillary muscle that usually ruptures is the posterior medial one. Okay, so there's another rupture. And this is a section through it, and you can see coagulation necrosis there. All right, here's another one, and they threw this one, this exact picture, because when I showed it, someone said, that was on my test. This is the interventricular septum here. That's the right ventricle, left ventricle. Here's your aorta over here. And right where this little white thing is, you can see a rupture right through there. So what kind of shunt do you think you have? Left to right. There you go. So you have a step what? Step up of oxygen in the right ventricle and pulmonary artery. And that's how they determine these things. They do catheterize them, and they notice that. Okay. Most interventricular septal ruptures are LAD thrombosis. This is a mural thrombus. Mural means wall, right? So when you put something, a mural, you're putting a mural on the wall, you're putting a picture on the wall. In this case, the mural is a thrombus on the wall. Okay. They're almost always LAD thromboses because you need a lot of space to stick. Now, this always drove me crazy, these mural thrombi. Why? Because I always wondered why, when you have an anterior myocardial infarction, they're always going to give you aspirin. Okay, and of course, now the purpose of that is to prevent thrombosis, another thrombosis of the coronary vessel, okay? And they usually always put you on warfarin heparin. Okay, now, why do they do that? Well, they do that to prevent mural thrombus from developing. Okay, so when you have an anterior, that's the greatest risk for this thing, they anticoagulate you. But it bothered me, aspirin and this for together, the warfarin and the heparin. I never quite understood it, and then it was only Boyd, the British textbook of pathology that mentioned that mural thrombi are mixed clots. They're not a pure venous-like clot. They're not a pure platelet-like clot. They're mixed. And then Boyd, best book written in pathology, best book, unfortunately, not out anymore. British, of course, because they're the only ones that know how to write to begin with, and then they really write well. That's another thing. I love British books. Here's how it works. You have a transmural infarction. Agreed that you have injury to the endothelial surface of the heart. So who's going to stick to that? Platelets. So platelets are the first things that stick to it. Okay, so there's your platelet part of it. And then, because of the fact that this ventricle is not contracting all that well, because infarcted muscles don't contract, there's stasis, and so on top of the platelets develops a venous-like clot. which has coagulation factors, fibrinogen 5 and 8 and RBCs and all that kind of stuff in it. So it's mixed. Some of it's platelets, the part that's attached to the endocardium, and the other part's kind of like a venous clot from stasis. And so you can see, by taking aspirin, you not only prevent a coronary thrombosis because of decreasing platelet aggregation, but you also prevent a mural clot from initially developing, mural thrombus, because it inhibits the platelets from aggregating. And secondly, by putting them on warfarin and heparin, you prevent the other part of the clot from developing. Very interesting. So I finally got the answer to that. You don't want one of these because these can embolize. Okay, so they're very dangerous. You've seen this before. This is called fibrinous pericarditis. This can occur two times in a person with acute myocardial infarction. First week, okay, and you're going to get a friction rub, chest pain, relieved by leaning forward, worse when leaning back, okay? Could be three-component friction rub. And that's just due to the transmural infarction, increased vessel permeability, da-da-da-da-da-da. They don't like that one. They like the history of a person with a transmural infarct, 6 weeks later, comes in with fever, muscle aches and pains, and they have a three-component friction rub in the chest. And it would look like this. What's the name of that syndrome? Drexler syndrome. Now, that's an autoimmune pericarditis. See, what happened is when you had your infarct, and you damage the pericardial surface, you develop autoantibodies against your pericardial tissue. And that took roughly 6 weeks to get a high enough titer of those things. And then you start attacking your pericardium, okay, and you ended up with kind of systemic symptoms related to that immunologic reaction. That's called Drexler syndrome, and they really, really like that one on boards. So you see this two times, potentially two times. First week, that's not autoimmune, and then 6 weeks later, that is autoimmune. And it basically treated with nonsteroidals. All right, now let's look at this. These are later complications. This is a ventricular aneurysm over here. Okay, now here's what this patient would say. Let's say he's 3 weeks out of the myocardial infarction transmural. He says, Doc, because he says, there's something weird that I'm noticing. That my chest... it bulges, and so the basically he says, watch this chest over here, because I can do this real well. Watch. He says, watch, doctor. Is there something under there? Yeah, a massive pectoralis major. So there's a systolic bulge. If you have dextrocardia, dextroan, okay. So this systolic bulge of the precordium is a ventricular aneurysm. Because blood is collecting in the aneurysm and bulging it out and makes your chest bulge out. It's an idiot diagnosis. Anyone can diagnose that. But it's a late manifestation, and here's how they're going to get you. You know it's a ventricular aneurysm, then they're going to ask you what the most common complication is, and you're going to pick rupture because of the fact that all aneurysms rupture. You'd be wrong here. You'd be wrong here. Because this aneurysm is lined by scar tissue. You ain't going to rupture it. The most common cause of death in a ventricular aneurysm, look at how much. How much of that left ventricle is covered by that aneurysm? Ooh, quite a bit of it. That's not contracting. So what do you think the most common cause of death? Heart failure. You got it right. Heart failure. Ejection fraction in this patient probably was 0.10. So you die of heart failure. Don't die of ruptures. A famous question. And I get so many students, aneurysm's got a rupture. Not this one. This one ain't going to rupture. This one ain't going to rupture. So don't fall for that one. Now, they tried to pass off this heart. They did have this on the boards as a acute myocardial infarction because they thought that students would think that this over here was an infarct. No, it ain't. That's fibrous tissue. That's fibrous tissue. No, that's way wider than a whiter-looking and very patchy-looking versus the pale infarct that you see. This is just scar tissue. In fact, left anterior descending right over here is completely obliterated. So this could be anywhere from, let's say, 3 weeks to 10 years, this heart. There's no way you can tell, you know, when this patient had their infarct based on this. So this is scar tissue. This is not an infarct. But I'm going to ask you a question. Look at how much of that scar tissue is involved there. Do you think that contracts? No. See, that's why they do ejection fractions before you leave a hospital with a myocardial infarction, because that determines whether you're going to live or die. If you got a reasonably good ejection fraction, that means you really didn't damage your myocardium that much, because you got a pretty good stroke volume out there. But if you got a low ejection fraction after you leave that hospital, that is not a good sign. That means you had a pretty big infarct with a lot of muscle that was destroyed, and you're going to have problems. Okay, so the ejection fraction actually is the best prognostic factor for how well you're going to do after an infarct. If it's reasonably normal, close to 0.66, not too, then you do good. But if you got talking about 0.40 or something like that, you're clearly going to have a big-time problem for the rest of your life. There's not a whole lot you can do about it. Unless you go maybe to some place in Brazil or something like that where that dude cuts that part out and puts it together again, then you probably could. Ooh. Right. Let's see. Before we continue on with this, how do we diagnose myocardial infarctions? Okay, what's the gold standard? CKMB. Why not the electrocardiogram? It's only got about an 80% sensitivity for showing a new Q wave, ST elevation, and ST and T wave changes. You never hang your hat on an EKG for diagnosing a myocardial infarction. They have great specificity. When you do see a new Q wave and ST elevation, good. But they have lousy sensitivity. Okay, that's not to say you don't do one. You do one. But CKMB is considered the gold standard. Now, night through, they're also adding troponin 1 into this thing, and some people are saying that that's going to replace CKMB. Baloney. I don't think they can do that, and I'll show you why that is. Now, CKMB, you recall, is an isoenzyme of creatine kinase. We have CKMM, MB, and BB. The MB isoenzyme is primarily in cardiac muscle, so that when you infarct it, the muscle, you're going to release that fraction, and so you'll see an increase in CKMB. Now, it usually comes up maybe after 6 hours. It peaks in one day, 24 hours, and it's gone in 3 days. Don't forget that 3 days. Because the CKMB is present after 3 days, that defines reinfarction. So the reappearance of CKMB after 3 days means reinfarction. Don't forget that. Now, troponin 1 is cool, because troponin 1 comes up a couple hours earlier, maybe as early as 4 hours after. It peaks in roughly the same time, 24 hours, but it lasts 7 days. Woo! Okay, so you're saying to yourself, well, let's use that, screw the CKMB. Well, how are you going to diagnose reinfarction? See, after day 3, troponin 1 is still going to be there. So how are you going to diagnose reinfarction? And so they're still going to keep CKMB, okay, because of the fact that troponin 1 is, you know, lasting for 7 days. I'll tell you what, it'll replace LDH isoenzymes. Remember, normally LDH2 is higher than LDH1, normally. But LDH1 is in cardiac muscle. So when you have an infarct, you release LDH1, then 1 becomes higher than 2. That's called the flip. See, normally 2 is higher than 1, but when you infarct in the muscle, then releasing LDH1, 1 is higher than 2. That's called the LDH1-2 flip, if you ever wonder what that meant. Okay? And here's how it works. About 18 hours is when that happens. It peaks in 3 days, 2 to 3 days, and it lasts for a week. Most of the time we used LDH isoenzymes when someone came in maybe 2 to 3 days after their chest pain. CKMB might have been gone. We do the LDH isoenzymes. We see 1-2 flip, and then we say, this patient had an MI in there in their third or fourth day of it or whatever. But that's going to be replaced by troponin 1 because that'll pick it up during that time frame anyway. So LDH isos will go, and troponin 1 will replace that, and so I think you'll see both of them being done. Okay? Okay. Some valvular diseases. Now I suspect probably 15-20% of you got this disease here. Probably all worried about it because I'm showing it on the screen here. Let me just see, check something out, okay? But what do you think this is? That's mitral valve prolapse. That's your most common mitral valve lesion, mitral valve prolapse. A lot of you have that thing. A little bit more common in women than men. What is it? Well, basically, it's too much valve. To me, it looks like a parachute. It's a good thing to remember, because just like air goes under a parachute and projects that and fills it all up, and you go up in the air within the parachute, okay, blood underneath this parachute will push and prolapse that mitral valve into the left atrium, and when it stops, it's going to make a noise. That's called a click. Whoa. So prolapse means, you know, whatever, you know, it means something's coming out. I mean, rectal prolapse, that means your rectum is coming out of your butt, okay? Mitral valve prolapse means it's prolapsing, it's extending into your left atrium. And so when it stops, you know, when eventually you can't go in anymore, it makes a noise. That's your click. And then it's followed by a short murmur of mitral regurge. So it's click murmur, not snap murmur, click murmur. Opening snaps occur in mitral stenosis, tricuspid stenosis, less commonly tricuspid. So it's click murmur, click murmur, click murmur, click murmur. Aye. Now, they have want to know what's the pathology? Answer, myxomatous degeneration. Ooh. Does anyone know what glycosaminoglycan makes up your valve? Dermatan sulfate, very good. So it's an excess of dermatan sulfate in your stinking mitral valve. And so it becomes redundant. Redundant, like a parachute. Lots of too floppy looking. Okay, it's got too much of it. And then blood's going to go underneath it, prolapse it in, make a click and murmur. And we will continue this because I'm going to tell you about what happens to the click and murmur when you stand up and lie down and when you're anxious, because that's on the boards.